Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. Manuel Buttigieg. Just a few words about my guest. Dr. Buttigieg is a senior lecturer in early modern history here at the University of Malta. He's a member of the Board of Studies of the MA in Hospitaller Studies, coordinator for the MA in Mediterranean Studies, and a visiting lecturer at the Institute for European Studies. He graduated BA Honours at the University of Malta in 2002. As part of his undergraduate studies, he studied at the University of Exeter as an Erasmus exchange student. In 2004, he was awarded a Commonwealth Cambridge Scholarship in order to read for an MPhil in early modern history at the University of Cambridge. He wrote a dissertation about childhood history in early modern Malta. In 2005, he was awarded further scholarships from the Arts and Humanities Research Council of Great Britain, the Cambridge Commonwealth Trust, and the Janitor Stubbs Foundation here in Malta in order to be able to pursue his studies at a doctoral level. His PhD dealt with nobility, faith, and masculinity in the Order of Malta in the 17th century. His PhD supervisor was Dr. Mary Laven of Jesus College. His college in Cambridge was Peterhouse. His first book was entitled Nobility, Faith and Masculinity, The Hospitaller Knights of Malta, 1580 to 1700. And I think actually you've been on this program to talk about that in the past. Yes.
Quite a while ago.
yes. Together with Dr. Simon Phillips of the University of Cyprus, he has also co-edited Islands and Military Orders, 1291 to 1798. That was in 2013. He's also the author of several papers in journals and edited books. At present, he is vice president ex officio of the Malta University Historical Society, and he was a committee member of the Malta Historical Society between 2011 and 2015. Dr. Buttigieg is happy to supervise dissertations dealing with early modern themes in general and the Order of St. John in particular. And I know that he does quite a few of those and enjoys them very much.
Indeed.
He also makes regular appearances on radio and TV programs as an expert guest speaker on a variety of historical themes and current affairs. Today, he'll be talking to us about rituals in early modern Malta, with a particular focus on harbour rituals. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Buttigieg.
Thank you, Patricia.
So, rituals, well, this sounds obviously like a very intriguing and interesting research, but do tell us how this project started. What made you actually go into this particular type of research?
Yes, so as you rightly said, I have a big interest in the Knights of St. John, and as I was studying there for my PhD, came across descriptions of rituals that they were involved in, but admittedly I didn't think too much about it at the time. Then came 2012, when Queen Elizabeth II was celebrating her jubilee, and one of the events organized was the big maritime pageant on the Thames. And I was sitting at home watching it on TV, luckily in nice warm Malta. I don't know if you recall, but the people there that day, it was raining, soggy.
Umbrellas out.
Yes, but there's still hundreds, if not more, of people watching and participating. And I thought to myself, hang on, the harbour of Malta, such a splendid space, there must have been things like this going on all the time. And that was the trigger. Like, let me see if I can find at least something. And to my very pleasant surprise, I found a lot, in fact, a lot of descriptions, a lot of things that were going on in this body of water, which over the whole period of the nights became increasingly splendid because of the increasing fortifications and other structures that they put up. And so I like very much the idea that you have a floating stage. where actors were playing out a variety of roles according to whatever they were commemorating or celebrating.
Of course, rituals are really embedded into our DNA almost, I think, that our very human existence is surrounded or is underpinned by rituals. Sometimes you think, oh, rituals and religion. In the case in which you're talking, it wasn't all religion. But there's so many areas of life, every area one touches, whether it's political, religious, the family even, military, there's so much ritual and acting, in inverted commas, going on. It's so much part of our life, really, isn't it?
It's true. I think, coming from a Catholic country, we're used to religious rituals in particular. You know, we have Holy Week. But it has a much broader meaning, just as you were hinting at, from the very basic level of our day-to-day rituals, which we often have, although we might not think about them in that way, to the grander spectacles. Now, in my own project, I am very much taking this very broad understanding of what ritual is. Spectacles, celebrations that were organized primarily by the Order of St. John as the government of these islands to mark significant moments and significant events. You can't always draw the line between what is political and what is religious, because this is an age where the two are very much blurred. And they were intended to create a sort of occasion where there could be a conversation of sorts between ruler and ruled. Admittedly, a scripted conversation. But as ever, when you organize something, as we well know, it can go off track. It can go not according to plan. So they were intended to make statements, but they could be risky situations as well.
Going back to Queen Elizabeth going down the Thames that very rainy day.
Yes.
At the moment, there's a lot of discussion in Canada and Australia about, you know, not having the Queen as the head and this sort of thing. In England or in Britain, she does still have this gelling effect very much amongst the people in Britain, whether they are left, right, centre, politically, whatever. Some are Republicans, but it's a very, very small majority. Most people in the political spectrum would like the idea of this monarchy. And I suppose even in the 16th century, the idea of trying to keep things together, to gel, was part of the reason why they went in for this sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. That's why these rituals were organized, as a way of bringing people together. The central actor was often the grandmaster, and this idea that, you know, he's there and he needs to be seen. He needs to be seen doing things. And by being there and doing things, he's doing things for his people, and the people are flocking to these occasions. Of course, it helped that often on these occasions there would be distribution of free food, and on some splendid, particularly splendid occasions, fountains of wine, as well as the distribution of coins, money. And they were fun, very often, so as political as they may have been, I like to emphasize that there was also the element of entertainment to it, which was always a crowd puller, then and now.
Absolutely. The one you mentioned in the notes that you sent me, the possesso ritual, particularly in Mdina and Bugo, I mean, that had a special significance. The first time it was done was particularly significant, but then it did get repeated then, an affirmation over the years, I suppose. But tell us what possesso really meant.
Okay, so the possesso was not unique to Malta to begin with. It was a ritual, an event, which was very much part of the currency of the way governments worked, certainly in the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries, but even before that. The idea was of a person, the ruler, taking formal possession of a city, which sometimes was also evocative of a territory. So princes, rulers, the Pope himself had a possessor of Rome, in fact, symbolically taking control of the city. And the first one that was held here was in 1530, soon after the Knights of St. John arrived, when Grandmaster Lilledam held his possessor of Imdina. Interestingly, he was invited by the council of Imdina, what's called the Università, to take the possesso. So it seems the initiative actually came from the Maltese side. The Grandmaster, of course, obliged, because it was a good occasion to, you know, really start meeting his people, now the people that he was going to be ruling over. We know that happened in 1530. We've assumed that it kept happening. But I recently supervised a student, Daniel Malia, who's run a very good MA in Hospitaller Studies dissertation about this subject. And in fact, for the first 100 years after that 1530 possesso, the evidence is very scant. So one might need to rethink how regularly this happened. What is certain, though, is that when the Pope becomes Grand Master, that's in the 1620s, he definitely has one. And not only that, the Pope then invents a new one, a possessor of Burgu. And with the Pope, you see a sense of the order now being firmly settled. The siege is over, Valletta's, you know, very much well on, and it's progressing in its development. And so these sort of events are even more important in helping to have this link to the place where you're living. I'm sure you're familiar, Patricia, with Favre's big, beautiful painting showing Lilledam taking possession. So we see it, you know, it's in the palace, if I remember correctly, but we see it reproduced very often in the most random of places as well. And that has been a very powerful molder, I think, of how we remember this episode. But we need to remember that the painting was done in the 18th century, so quite a while after the original event. But it has been, and this was one of the things that I told Daniel to investigate, in fact, it has been a powerful frame through which we've seen this event. And so we've tried to unpack it a little bit. I don't know if you recall also in the early 90s, at least we used to have that flower festival in Imdina, which included a sort of recreation of this event. And I think that has also influenced our own picture of this particular event. But now we're partly through this research, we're starting to unpack it, understand it. One thing we've understood is that it evolved over time. The Lilledam one was splendid, but by the time Pinto comes along, the mid-18th century, that was spectacular. A train of carriages from Valletta to Imdina, 9 triumphal arches erected on the way, poetry being read at particular spots on the way, cavalry, soldiers, and that sort of spectacle is done not just for the sake of having it, but to really make a statement that this is a principality that equals any other principality of that moment.
Fancied himself as a king, really, Pinto, didn't he?
Yes, but he wasn't the only one, really. No. he had a way of manifesting it.
Going back to that Favre picture, a comment that Daniel makes, actually, is that in the picture, the door is open.
Yes.
Whereas, in actual fact, in the original Lilledam arrival, the door would have been shut.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, knock, knock, yes, you can come in idea. And I thought that was very interesting and reflected, as you're saying, the fact that Favre was painting it a long time later and with a different social and political
framework
so that not to use the word agenda. But in fact, what went on before he actually did the possesso in 1530, politically, behind the scenes, I feel sure that the Siculo Maltese nobility didn't throw the door open and welcome him with open arms.
No.
There must have been some negotiating going on in the background.
Yeah, we do know that there was, well, first of all, resistance to the idea, but then when it was clear that they could not stop it, because there were larger forces, the emperor essentially, that they could not stop, yes, there were these sort of discussions, and the possesso was not just a simple hello, sort of, or a big feast, all the elements in it, symbolic keys, books, clothes, they were there to say something. The fact that everyone was wearing black, black-colored clothes, was because black was the most expensive dye. It was also considered an incorruptible color because you can't change black. And both the Grandmaster and the Maltese dignitaries were wearing black. And they would have all understood this language without having the need to say it. It was also a sort of unwritten agreement that he is taking, Lelam's taking possession of the islands, but there is a political structure and a culture here. And there has to be a dialogue that goes on between the two sides.
I've said before, and I was rather amused, that there's a restaurant in Mdina which is called 1530. And I've always wondered why Mdina would want to celebrate 1530 when really, in a way, it was the moment when they said, okay, you know, we have to succumb to these new arrivals. So perhaps it wasn't a great day to be celebrated, but perhaps it was putting a good face on the situation and succumbing to the inevitable, really.
Yes, and then eventually finding a way to live with the new system and even profit from the new system.
So, in a general sense, I mean, why is it important that we should go back and look at these things and study these moments?
I think that when taking this particular perspective of rituals, what I'm trying to do is move a bit the parameters that we usually have for looking at the period of the knights. There tends to be a narrative of, you know, the knights coming in, they rule everything, and the Maltese are out. For me, that doesn't make sense. They could never have run this place successfully without cooperation from the local population at various levels. And rituals were an important moment when the two sides could come together. They also help us to understand the way the political structure worked. They were an essential building block for the political establishment of the early modern period. They still are, after all, because even modern governments have rituals. But perhaps even more so at that point, when, say, literacy was low, and so a ritual was a very good way of communicating to a large number of people. And people did flock to these events. So by looking at that, we're really trying to enrich and complicate a bit more the picture that we have of these, you know, almost 300 years. It's also more colorful, which is fun in itself and interesting, and it helps us to see things from a political angle still, but from a wider political angle, as I see it.
The possessor of Mdina would have meant, especially as you mentioned in Pinto's time, we're getting late on now in the 18th century, would have been overland.
Yes.
And quite a distance if we're going to talk about perhaps going from Valletta to Mdina.
They did start quite early, in fact, like 4 or 5 a.m.
Yeah, it would take some time to get the roads. Can't have been wonderful.
No, and especially if they're going with all those carriages and all those pit stops they do on the way. Uh-huh.
And you mentioned actually these building of arches. I mean, that's something that you see even in Malta today.
Yes, in the festas.
In the festas. One particular one, which I always love, is the Feast of St. Paul in Valletta.
Uh-huh.
They build one at the top of one of the roads that goes down towards the harbour.
Right.
And it always interests me. It's very, very pretty because it's when you look through it, it frames the view at that point.
And one assumes that these arches we see today erected during festas are an inheritance from this sort of events, in fact.
So I'm trying to imagine this tour from Valletta to Mdina with these building up these arches and carriages, and it must have been incredibly spectacular.
Yes, and you also have to bear in mind that in order to have all of that, there must have been quite an army of artisans, artists, laborers, very capable, who could be called upon to create all of this. Unfortunately, so far, I've not been able to find much information about them. Usually in other places, they were able, in other countries, they were able to find information through the accounts, usually what people got paid and so on. So I'm hoping that once I get around to those, there may be insights into them as well.
And what about the ones for Bugo? You mentioned the harbour, of course, being a wonderful possible backdrop mm-hmm. for this. Do we have evidence that they actually used the water to go around and visit the different parts of the harbour, perhaps, before going to Bugo?
Yes, well, they use the harbour extensively and all the time. For one thing, we have evidence that a number of grandmasters, at least as early as De Paul, so 1620s, had a personal ceremonial boat, which they called a gondola. Now, it's not like the Venetian one that we're used to today, because gondola was a generic term used for any kind of ritualistic boat. But they had it, it's recorded, and they would use it to cross from Valletta to Bergamo in particular on quite a number of occasions. So it would be berthed usually somewhere where, you know, today just a bit further down from what we have Victoria Gate, no? Somewhere around that area. And the Birgo Possesso would have been often the first big occasion a grandmaster would have had in those areas, in the harbour waters. But then occasionally we know they were invited, say, to go to the Senglea feast. So certainly one example I came across. When a new inquisitor arrived, he had to, after settling in his palace in Bergo, he had to go and give his credentials to the grandmaster. Very often he did it, with the grandmaster sending his gondola to pick him up and ferry him over on the other side. So the traffic is continuous, really, between the two sides.
This link between Bergo and Valletta, that, since I've been living in Malta, was very limited.
Mm.
One got the impression, or had this idea, that somehow, after the war, the links between Valletta and the three cities were cut and never really restored. And it's only now that we're seeing a ferry going from exactly from where you're saying, in Valletta, right across to the monument at outside Bugo. So this link is coming again, because it seems so strange to me all those years, thinking, gosh, there's the harbour. The link could be so much better, but it never was.
You're absolutely right, because, well, it's very strong during the period of the Knights. It keeps being strong, perhaps even stronger in the British period. But then when after independence, 64, and after the former closure of the naval base in 1979, it's true, it kind of dies out. And I remember reading something about Barcelona actually having a similar experience to Malta, that following the Second World War period, more or less, it also, like Malta, in a sense, gave its back a bit to the sea, ironically enough. Which I think happened to us as well. We were focusing on creating industrial estates, on proper airport, and so on. But then comes something around. In the case of Barcelona, it was the Olympics in the early 90s. In the case of Malta, I think it's been possibly the cruise liner industry. That reminds you that actually you should logically be looking out to the sea as your ancestors had done. And following on that, it has been revived, as you will say. And as far as I know, because I use the service quite regularly, it seems to be thriving, because it makes so much perfect sense to be using it.
And also the marina at Bugo, of course, the marina there has also increased this idea of that they are part of the water, part of the sea.
As I see it, you have the marina of Bugo, let's call it that, and the marina of Valletta, and they were, the time of the Knights, in a constant dialogue between them. One thing which happened when Valletta was created and developed was that the Knights really would have liked all of their key operations to be there, including the arsenal. And they did try a couple of times to have an arsenal in Valletta where they could build and fix their boats, ships, but never quite worked. So that had to remain in Bergo, as well as the having, say, the palace of the admiral of the navy, and all these other facilities. So just for that dialogue had to continue. And each time a possesso happened, as I see it, was a reaffirmation of this intimate connection between the two sides. One serves certain purposes, the other purposes, but they are really one. And there's this duality. In fact, a nice perspective into it is that whenever the galleys sailed out from Bergo, they would first stop at the Valletta Marina to take on water from what was the Neptune Fountain, which was originally there. That's the one that's in the palace today. and then they would say aloud. So there's all these moments when this is reaffirmed, this very intimate connection between the two sides, which are really one.
And now that there are the local councils, I think that perhaps they are trying to revive the importance and lessen the isolation of the three cities. Each of the mayors does this. I mean, you can see very clearly that's what they're doing. And the Bilgofest, of course, has become extremely popular, almost too popular. It's absolutely packed for the people at that time. And so they would be keen to reenact, shall we say, the kind of rituals that were commonplace or were done during the time of the knights.
Yes, I would imagine. These events that happened in this period are what I call sensual feasts, because they were really meant to appeal to your senses in a very holistic manner. You have flags, you have music, you have a lot of sound, a lot of banging, because cannons are being shot, blank shots, continuously. They thunder, in fact, is the word that they use in the sources. There's just sound of the water splashing continuously, plus the distribution of food, sometimes wine, church bells are ringing in the background. Music, there are sometimes descriptions of music, violin and flute and so on being played. This cacophony, it would have enveloped you. And that was very much the idea. That's why earlier on also is the theater metaphor, because it does really explain it. Now imagine if you're standing in the gondola as the Grand Master in the middle of harbor between Sant'Angelo and Valletta. All the fortifications and the marinas are full of people watching, and there's all of this going on. It must have been a very, very interesting dynamic.
Absolutely magnificent. Well, our time has come to an end, unfortunately. I'd like to thank Dr. Manuel Buttigieg for coming to talk to us about the possesso of the time of the knights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.